and welcome to The Lovely Life with Trina McNeely. I'm going to help you learn to love your life, your everyday life. Not the one that you idealize from Instagram or the one that's on the other side of overwhelm, stress, and anxiety. I'm talking about the one that you woke up to today. This is a podcast about learning to live better spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically, no matter what you're going through. Living the lovely life doesn't mean that your life is devoid of pain and problems or that everything looks perfect. Quite the opposite. It's simply learning to find beauty in the midst of the mess and choosing to participate in your life, even when it's not going your way. In this conversational and contemplative podcast, you can expect thoughtful interviews, faith-filled encouragement, and practical tips to help you create space for peace and joy today. So listen in, friend, because together we're going to learn how to make our everyday a little easier, more meaningful, and truly beautiful. Hey, lovely life listeners, I have a question for you. Are you experiencing stress and overwhelm in your life? I wish we could be sharing a cup of coffee or a pot of tea and you could answer that for me personally. But my guess is that your answer is yes. So my next question is, how well do you handle stress and overwhelm? Sometimes it's really hard to answer that question on our own. With that in mind, I've created a fun 1-minute quiz to help you determine how well you are handling stress and overwhelm in your life. Are you managing it or is it managing you? Head over to my website, trinamcneely.com/uncluttery-your-soul to take the quiz and find out how you rate and a next step that you can take to begin to handle stress and overwhelm in your life in a healthy and productive way. That's trinamcneely.com/uncluttery-your-soul to take the How Well Do You Handle Stress and Overwhelm quiz. Hello, lovely life listeners. Today is a treat. I am speaking with Mary Marantz, who you may know from her popular podcast, The Mary Marantz Show, or her wonderful memoir, Dirt. Well, today I'm chatting with Mary about her new book, Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots, Finding Grace, Freedom, and Purpose in an Overachieving World. I'm going to start with a little excerpt from her book that I want you to hear before we get into this conversation. You know her. Maybe you are her. The woman who feels like she must always be on. The one who is always performing. She walks into every room relentlessly hard on herself, always attempting to deliver an A+ performance because she believes there is the bare minimum standard she has to achieve just to be invited to most tables. You would never know by looking at her the hard things she's had to overcome. She succeeds almost compulsively in this urgent attempt to outrun her own muddy story. But she is walking around now, reduced to this burned out, brittle, fragile, ashes to ashes version of herself. She is, at last, exhausted. If you are exhausted, this podcast is for you today. Mary says, "We're not in a race with anyone. Good things take time. Real things take time, and slow growth equals strong roots." Hi, Mary. Welcome to The Lovely Life.
Oh, Trina, thank you so much for having me. We are doing such a fun swap here where we just had you on my show, The Mary Marantz Show. So I'm really excited to get to hop over here and turn the tables.
Yes, I know. I am so excited to keep talking. This just feels like such a fun day to have these longer form conversations and just talk about growth and what could be better than that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I want to tell my listeners, like you told yours, we are both Enneagram 4s, which makes this extra fun. And we have a unique understanding then. I want to talk about your new book. It's called Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots. You know, I say, actually, coming from the Midwest, I say not roots, but root. Slow growth equals strong roots.
Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. You know who else does? Jennifer Dukes-Lee.
Okay.
I heard her saying that. And I was like, wait a minute. She's from Iowa. I'm from Illinois. Anyways, we're going to say it right. Slow growth equals strong roots. Finding grace, freedom, and purpose in an overachieving world. Mm. Oh, I love this. I'm a slow growth kind of girl by nature. So my heart kind of sings when someone is going to tell us how to do this and really why it matters when the world kind of offers us a different way. Mm, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this just a few minutes ago on my show that both of us are embracing and championing and trying to, you know, steward into the world a message that is not naturally rewarded by the world, right? The world is not a big fan of it's just going to take longer than you think. And the character traits that you grow in the process are going to be more important than any outcome. That doesn't sell magazines. You know, that does not move. Here are your 10-step checklist freebies on the internet. People first want the quick fix. They want the things that can just be like, tell me what to do and I'll go do it and I can get back to my life. And to a certain extent, this book deals with that right off the bat, because this book opens up with what I say is our inciting incident, this plot point, this spark, this, you know, change, the scene that's going to set our protagonist off on a narrative arc that will hopefully leave her utterly and forever changed by the end. Our inciting incident is this breathless and at last exhausted. And Trina, that phrase comes from a passage that is actually near the end of my first book, Dirt, which is the story of growing up in a single wide trailer in rural West Virginia on top of a mountain and eventually making my way to Yale Law School. And it's much, we've all heard, you know, the humble beginnings to Ivy League story before. That's sort of the elevator pitch version. But I always say this book, that book, Dirt, is really about making peace with your past and making peace with your story. And so I write that at the end of Dirt, only to realize we're only halfway there. It's actually the end of the first book becomes the inciting incident, the starting point of the second. So if it's okay, it's like a couple paragraphs. I'm just going to read that so you know, and your listeners know what I mean by this is the spark that sets off the entirety of book two. And so it says, at a certain point, you stop running. Breathless and at last exhausted, you double over at the pain of a lifetime spent proving. You've run so hard for so long, you've gone so far out into the world, only to keep finding yourself back at the beginning. You have spent a lifetime starting over, breaking loose to run free, only to be taken captive again and again. This one truth always dragging, always clawing at your heels like the heavy chains you never asked to bear. No matter how hard you run, you can't outrun you. So you crawl there for a while, panting through the pain, and then you curl up in surrender and rest your face on the cool, hard ground. Death to this old life you once knew, a mourning of what was lost before the thrill of hope takes flight, a dying of self to become a new thing, this time one with both roots and wings. God set me free of me. And it goes on to say, are you finally reaching the end where all this running has only left you at last exhausted? Have you tried and failed to find belonging in a myriad of ways only to realize it never works? Good. Now the real work can begin.
Mm. That's so beautiful. I'm so glad you read that so that everyone can hear what a beautiful writer you are.
Thank you.
I don't say that about everybody. Good writing really matters to me. And you write in a really poetic and lyrical way with so much depth to it, which is the best kind of writing in my opinion.
Thank you for sharing that.
You can't outrun you. I think that is something... it's a place that we all find ourselves at some point if we're going to really be paying attention to our own lives. So tell us a little bit about how you got to that point where you figured out that you can't outrun yourself any longer.
Yeah, I mean, the honest answer and the answer for everybody listening is that it's that I just tried and tried and tried and tried and tried for years and years. And maybe there's somebody listening right now who resonates with that, where it's like, you keep giving in to the siren song of maybe one more sweater, or maybe when we renovate that living room, maybe when we get that house. And you continue to try, but the verve and the gusto with which you are trying has started to go down, because there is just this dawning in your soul of, you kind of already know what's coming. You can get those beautiful things. I'm not saying don't build a beautiful life or a lovely life. Like, I am a big fan of those things. Yeah. But it's just like, are you doing them to try to fill a hole in your heart? Mm-hmm. That's never going to work. And so for me, one of the first times, and it's, you know, it's both practical because it's the first time I can really identify it happening, but it's also heartbreaking because it was 20 years ago, was when I got my acceptance letter to Yale Law School, which is the number one law school in the country. Don't let Elle Woods fool you. it's Yale, not Harvard. You know, when I got that acceptance letter, there's a part in Dirt where I say, you know, there's a reason we flip the channel on the underdog movie when the hero finally gets everything they ever wanted. You know, we do not stay around to see what happens to Rudy after he gets his time on the field, right? There's a reason we cue the score and roll the credits. And it's because nobody wants to sit with someone once they've gotten everything they want. They become insufferable. They start using words like whom properly in a sentence. Mm-hmm. And I say, but what if six, no offense if anybody does that. It's just, I don't. So it's just a funny. But what if success is where the real trouble began? What if you still go home at night after you've gotten the biggest dream come true and lay down at night in the cool cotton sheets and you still can't rest peacefully, right? What if you still feel like a waking, walking imposter and you scream at your thin epidermis, every raw nerve ending burning on display? What could you possibly still want? Mm. What is it? What is going to be enough to satisfy you? So I felt it for the first time when this journey from single wide trailer to Yale Law School, you know, turn that into a movie right there.
Yeah.
The next week you feel like you, but you in a gray cardigan, right? I talk about buying my first J. Crew cardigan to try to fit in, and it itches on your skin. It doesn't quite fit. It's just you, but you in a gray cardigan. And so there's one of my favorite parts I go through is I talk about this hole in my heart, which really felt to me more like, you 1980s kids will appreciate this, that movie Death Becomes Her, where, you know, Goldie Hawn's got like basically like a cannonball size hole all the way through her where guts and backbone used to be.
I forgot about that movie.
Yeah. you see right through her. Anybody can see right through her. And that I spent years trying to backfill that hole with gold stars and highlight reels and designer labels and a ton of achievements and a big, beautiful life. Only to realize that I started somewhere along the line to treat God like a Pez dispenser, like keep the candy coming, God. These sugary sweet highs of getting everything I ever wanted. You know, you need more and more, faster and faster, because the hit and the high, you get that tolerance and you need more quicker just to feel the same. And so there's this part where it's like talking about how that hole in my heart feels like a root canal the size of a chest wound. So it shouldn't surprise me that at some point after all of this filling, what I realized most was that it was not sugary sweet filling that I needed, but an excavation, which is where our books come, you know, they go so well together with this idea of what unlovely things do you need to let go of?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I want to know, Mary, for you, when did you have that realization that it wasn't enough, that when you got that J. Crew sweater, did you realize right away that it itched and that now you wanted more J. Crew sweaters? Or maybe J. Crew wasn't good enough at that point. And, you know, I'm just speaking metaphorically, but, you know, it was the next thing. When did you have that realization?
You know, I think that's such a great question. And I think the answer is that it's with the first bite and it's with the last bite. And what I mean by that is I want you to picture a bag of marshmallows and you take a bite of that first marshmallow and you know, it's sweet and it's like that first hit of sugar and you get a little rush from it and you're like, oh, this is kind of fun. But like, there's a part of your brain that's like, that's not really very healthy for you. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, cool, cool, cool. But then I'm going to take another bite and the like sweet factor and the rush factor goes down and you're still incredibly hungry. But maybe I'll just take another one and I'll take another one. And you continue compulsively eating all the marshmallows in the bag only to be the hungriest you've ever been. It's an excellent way to spend your whole life starving.
Yeah.
And you knew it with the first bite, but there was just like this part of your brain that needed to see it through. You needed to find out if maybe it was going to be the next one and the next one and the next one. Mm-hmm. And so now we're addicted to the sugar. We're addicted to the rush and we're starving. We're hungry. Our souls are starved. And to a certain extent, that feeling that you can probably all picture right now of just how ill you would feel after eating an entire bag of marshmallows by yourself, that's that feeling. That's that feeling of, now I can maybe start to pay attention to this. I wish that it came sooner. For some people, maybe it will. But for me, I really had to feel just sick. Just like I ate so much of the empty calories that I finally like didn't want any more of them. Like right. I didn't want another marshmallow in my life. So I say in the book, we do not give up achieving once and then we're done with it, right. Achieving for our worth. It is like anything we've become addicted to. It's every single day, a choice we have to make one day at a time.
Yeah. And, you know, you say ultimately, this is a book about breaking free from achieving your worth. And you talk about this in that you're not writing it from the mountaintops, but from the trenches, from a place of exhaustion. And I'm wondering if you could tell us more, because if someone is just taking a glance at your life through the squares on the screen of Instagram, they're going to look and see Mary, who is beautiful, and you've got a beautifully curated feed, and you know, to our eyes, you're successful. You're coming out with your second book. You've got an amazing podcast. You're a wonderful person. So tell us a little bit about what that looks like. Because sometimes we don't always share. I mean, I know we do in our books, right? You do in your book, I do in mine. But for those that obviously haven't read the book yet because it's new, tell us about that place of exhaustion and what that looked like and why you wrote from that place and maybe why that's important to write from that place.
Yeah, 100%. First of all, I think it's so interesting. I think it's so interesting for you to describe that outside looking in perspective, because I will say that it has become increasingly important to me over the last several years to be very transparent about things that are hard or that are not working. Like not in a sense of faux vulnerability, which is a whole other episode that I could go off on. That is not my deal at all. But to be true, you know, like I wrote a post a few days ago about crying for 3 days straight in the desert when I went on this retreat, this women's retreat my publisher put on, because I felt like I was in a desert of striving and achieving and trying to chase people and earn approval and all the things. So, but what's important about what just happened there is that what our brains do, I think as humans, but especially as women, is when we look at other people, Christy Wright talked about this in her most recent book. When we look at other people, we hyper-focus on their wins. When we look at us, we hyper-focus on our shortcomings. And so even when there has been a shift in my social media, it can still feel like, just from like first glance, that it's, you know, gold star after gold star, win after win, like keep it coming. And it's just not that way at all. And so when I talk about, I wanted to make clear that I was writing this book from the trenches, it's because I didn't have any other choice. Like I do not have any idea what it's like to stand on the mountaintop moment of never once achieving for your worth again. So if you're worried, I'm going to read this book and again, like Elle Woods it, like what? Like it's hard. Just like get your identity in Christ and then start running on your mission and never once struggle with comparison again. That is not this book. You do not worry about that. This is not this book. This book is, I don't know any other way but then to fight my way through the mud and just document it as I go. Because I am someone who, you know, for a long time, we talked about being Enneagram 4s. For a long time, I thought I was an Enneagram 3 because I do have a very strong 3 wing. But then somebody had me look up Enneagram 4, self-preserving Enneagram 4, where if we grow up with a hard story, we can present as achievers as a way to get to safety. And that's something I talk about in Dirt, where I talk about the girl in the red cape running from the big bad wolf. She feels like if she stops, it might kill her. And so when I say I'm writing from the trenches, it starts with this question I ask myself a bunch of times, like pulling my own hair, banging my head against the wall. Like, is this something you can even ever do? Is it even possible to stop achieving for your worth? Especially if you're like me and you're in your 40s and you have a good set of decades behind you of wiring your brain to want that dopamine hit, to see your worth this way, to earn approval and love by the gold stars you can provide to people. And so there was this like moment of fear and you know, I got to tell you, like we could also have a whole conversation about the attacks that come when you're going to release a message that might actually set people free. And there is an enemy and a darkness that does not want these words out into the world, because the way I attack it is I look at achieving for your worth like the center hub of a bicycle wheel, and then we go around the wheel to every single spoke that feeds into that. Other people's expectations, the checklist of other people's successes, the filters through which we believe the world sees us, how they look at us, this I'll be happy when stuff. So we talk about it from all sorts of different perspectives, because those were all the things that I struggled with that ultimately led to I kept achieving for my worth.
Yeah. Wow. Talking about achieving for our worth, let's look at it from this angle, because you have a chapter titled The Checklist of Other People's Success. Mm-hmm. And you say, if you and I are going to give up achieving for our worth, then we are also going to have to give up other people's versions of success.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Yeah. Why is that? And expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. So, let me just preface this. And I think this is important to hear. So many of the times when we're about to say something to somebody that could truly help them and could truly change their lives, there's going to be a lot like a voice in your head going, that's so childish. Mm. That's such a childish way of thinking about that.
Yeah.
But when I was thinking of the checklist of other people's success, I said, it's kind of like this. It's like you see that person over there on Instagram do A. And so your brain goes, cool, cool. So I have to do A to be successful. Got it.
Yeah.
Then you see that person you went to high school with doing B. So your brain goes, awesome. B, we have to do B to be successful. Check. Got it. Then you see C happen with somebody at work. They, you know, pay off their mortgage or whatever. Okay, got it. C, add C to the list. But your brain does this really tricky sleight of hand where it doesn't go, you can either do A, B, or C, and the world will go, man, look what they've done. Mm-hmm. Your brain goes, got it, A, B, and C. That's what I have to do to be successful. And it doesn't stop at C. It keeps going all the way through until you have, you know, double Z. You've got 52 things on your list that now become your checklist of success. And so what I believe happens for us when we are adding these things to the list is we forget to even ask ourselves if that matters to us, if that feels like what we believe success to be. It's just like, that's what you do. And you get that right. You get, you know, you kind of get comfortable with that and fix it a little bit in like your place at home, or maybe your place among your couple friends, or for those of you who are moms, you as mothers, maybe you get it a little bit under control in one area of your life. And then achieving for your worth is tricky. It comes, you know, you're looking at the front and the back door, and it comes in the side door. Now in the form for me of launching a book, it's like amazing. Here's a new checklist with literal lists that you're supposed to hit.
Right.
And so when we say we have to give up other people's versions, it's both like just grabbing them from a distance saying, got it, that's what you have to do any of this well. But it's also, this was the really eye-opening part for me. It's also saying, when I achieve for my worth, what I'm implicitly saying is that there need to be other people there to witness it and somehow deem it worthy. Mm. And if those people either don't think it's worthy, or they absolutely do think it's worthy, but they withhold that approval in an effort to make you feel small, to not get ahead of them, you know, man, you want to know who's for you, go through really, really hard times or really, really good times.
Right.
Those people get quiet real quick who are not for you. And so we're putting our worth in the hands of people who may not ever deserve it, instead of coming to God and saying, you tell me what you want me to do today. You tell me what's enough. You tell me when to rest. You tell me when to reap and when to sow and when to, you know, do all of the things you're calling me to. What do you say success looks like in my life? And it really kind of gets pretty simple. Love God and love people and use these gifts I've given you, this story I've given you to serve the world. You know, there's a part in my book that's, I need to have on, like we talked about sticky notes when you were on my show.
Yeah.
I need to have a sticky note just like plastered around my house to remind me, because I forget. And it is this, the use of my gifts in service to others for God's ultimate glory for the rest of my life. Mm. That's it.
Wow.
And I forget that. I forget that. And I buy another sweater. Yeah.
Is that your definition of success?
I do. I do think it's that. I really, really do. I think it's just like this very humble, open palm offering. You know, this book in a lot of ways is such a living, breathing example of that, because we were talking before I hopped on, I was a full-time photographer for 15 years with my husband, Justin. And when I signed a deal to write books with my publisher, this is book 2 of 5 that we're doing together. I felt like I had to silence that identity as a photographer. I had to shut that down for a while so I could establish an identity as an author and be taken seriously and a full-time author or what have you. And now I'm realizing God never asked me to choose that. God has given me a few different gifts. And look, they can actually intersect mm-hmm. in a really powerful way. My gift of storytelling generally is really what it is. It's a gift of photography. It's a gift of words.
Yes.
And it intersects with this story I've been given that can be used to help people. And so I'm just going to offer it all up. I'm going to offer the photography. I'm going to offer the design. I'm going to offer the words and hope that they help people.
That's beautiful. Definitely a storytelling arc to what you do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that. So I'm curious, because we kind of got into this a wee bit when we did it IG Live a couple weeks ago when my book came out. We were talking about success and kind of our origin stories. And mm-hmm. I was talking about my dad a little bit. Then you talked about your dad and kind of different ends of the spectrum. But I'm curious, do you believe that our origin story plays into our need to overachieve and how so?
100%. 100%. I mean, I was talking about this the other day with someone and I was saying, you know, it's so interesting how our blessings and our burdens can be just so closely linked to one another.
Yeah.
And wow. So just like parts of a spectrum. And so what I mean by that is I had a dad who was 12 years old when he went to go work in the woods and didn't really have a lot of options, never like barely graduated high school. College was not even on the radar, who always determined that I'm an only child, that his only daughter was going to go to college, was going to have an easy life, was going to get out. And that is a blessing and a burden, because the way that it was always articulated was, you're going to go out and make your old dad proud. You're going to go out and you're going to, you know, be successful. And you're going to make your old dad proud. You're going to get the A pluses. And there's a scene in Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots where I say, when I was going into second grade, I remember the first time there was an actual literal worth attached to my achieving, because my parents started paying me $5 for A pluses, $4.50 for A's, $4 for A minuses, and then it dropped off. And by the time dropped off steeply, by the time it was C plus range, I had to pay them. So there was a cost to being average.
Wow.
And it was just sort of this like a mask that I put on as a child, that like, you earn love, you earn belonging by making people proud, and you make people proud by not doing anything short of A plus territory.
Yeah.
You know, there's a real quick story in the book in Dirt where I talk about being 4 and my dad wanted me to stand in front of the entire church at the Christmas pageant and read 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, start to finish from memory, not read it, but actually recite it from memory. And I did it flawlessly the first year and messed it up the second year, which is another story. But the thing that he said to me right before I went on was, don't fidget and don't mess it up. So there was very little room for error, you know? And I think if you asked him now, you'd say, that was never my intention to make you think that's what you had to do to earn love. But two little eyes and little ears that we're still walking around with, those littlest versions in us, we learn that and we forget to unlearn it.
Right. Yeah. Wow. I remember that story. You talked about that when we did the Instagram Live as well, and that really stuck with me. So yeah, it is interesting. I've ever since we had that conversation and starting to dig into your book, I really am looking into the idea of success. Actually, before that too, because I think we just have so many wrong definitions of success, right? And so much of it is formed by what we saw or what was expected of us when we were growing up. And then we're like trying to achieve this. I love how you've got the A and B and C. Like, I never thought about that, like taking on all these other people's and then putting them together. It's just too much. It's overwhelming and an overload. But also like how we pick up in our own way, in our, like you said, little eyes and ears, what we think success is, and then you're striving for it and you don't even really know why or what it is. So I'm really interested in picking that apart in my own life. And I know your book's really going to help me do that. So I'm excited to do that. I want to talk about these 5 types of overachievers. I believe you have a test for it, which is so fun. A quiz, not a test, a quiz where we can find out our overachiever type. Will you give us like a quick synopsis of the 5 types?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the thing you need to know about this is such a testament of like, man, God, you are so funny and you are working when we do not realize it. Mm-hmm. So 5 or 6 years ago, like 2015, 2016 era, I guess maybe that's more like 6 or 7 years ago at this point. Oof. Anyway, Justin and I were getting kind of burned out in our photography business. We were doing everything for our clients, for magazines, for whatever the case may be. And there was always a shot list and a time, you know, on the clock, and yeah, we were always rushed. And so we decided to put some shoots together just for us. We did a ballerina shoot here in New Haven with our friend Katie as the model. And then shortly after that, we took a small team of us, including Katie again, to Venice, Italy. And we did a few different looks while we were there. And we came back and we legitimately edited up like 3 favorites and posted them on Instagram. And that's all we ever did with them. We didn't know what we were going to do with these photos. So they have just sat on hard drives for the last 6 or 7 or whatever it is years. And then I start writing this book and I don't even have those photos in my head at all. Mm-hmm. Just writing the manuscript in a Word document. And I'm trying to put words to what it's like for me to be this, quote, woman who is always performing. This woman who does not know how to drop the act or come up short or whatever. And so I just find myself in different parts of the book describing it in different ways. There's this part that says, you know, I've always wanted to be this person who is unshakable, the unsinkable Molly Brown. But that's never been me. I've always been more like this high wire tightrope walker. I'm up and I'm down and I'm everywhere in between. And I'm living for the thrill of that high that will catch me just in time. These hot air currents billowing up beneath me that give way to the fickle fog of their absence, leaving tiny thunderstorms of destruction in their wake. I'm up and I'm down and everywhere in between. And my days have always been defined as good or bad by the latest good thing that's happened to me. Mm. So that's a part. And then there's other parts, and I'll explain them in a second. And so we're trying to do the mock-ups for the book and nothing was coming back quite right. None of it really felt like me. And Justin said, what if you did something that was like our photography brand? It always had this kind of like blush and dark gray and very Vanity Fair, strong on typography. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he said that, it was like all the puzzle pieces snapped into place. And I feel like God just gave me like a bump of those images in my mind. And mm-hmm. It was like such an epiphany moment of like those photos perfectly line up with what I'm describing, these characters. Mm-hmm. And so the 5 characters of the woman always performing, because God was writing this book 6 or 7 years ago, apparently, are the performer. So the performer loves to set big goals. She's always on her toes, but it's very important to her that other people also perceive her differently because of them. She wants them to see how far she's come, to see that they were wrong about her, that her story was not a mistake. The tightrope walker, by contrast, does not care, could care less who's clapping, but she's living for these ever-increasing dopamine highs, these bigger risks. She needs the win to be bigger just to feel the same. Her days are as good or bad as the latest good thing that's happened. The masquerader is so terrified of disappointing either herself or other people that she hides right there in plain sight. She's afraid to even get started because in the face of the risk of creating failure, it feels safer to create nothing. The contortionist is not particularly driven by big goals herself, but she will chase them and twist herself up into tiny tethered knots because to contort is easier than to be criticized by other people. And the illusionist in the distance also stays stuck like the masquerader, but not for fear of failure. It's because she is so future focused. She lives for this illusion of herself in the distance that says, when I can be that perfect version of myself, then and only then can I begin. So the quiz takes like a minute, maybe a couple minutes, depending on how much you ponder them. And it will give you which of the 5 you are. But more importantly for me, we spent months putting this together. Mm-hmm. It will tell you what your strengths are because each type has them. Mm-hmm. It will tell you the places you get stuck and tripped up because each type has them. And it will tell you sort of your next action plan of this is what it looks like for you and your type to give up achieving for your worth and lean into working with purpose. And so you can find that at achieverquiz.com, achieverquiz.com.
Oh, I'm so glad you shared that. And that just sounds like an amazing resource in itself.
Yeah.
So I haven't taken the quiz yet, but you know, I'm going to do it as soon as we get off here. And I'm guessing that I'm either the contortionist or the masquerader. So I'm going to find out. Thank you for sharing that. I want to know, you talked about the wolf, okay? And I saw I think it was an Instagram reel where you were reading an excerpt from the book about the wolf. And at a certain point, you say that the big bad wolf is afraid of us. What do you mean by that?
Ooh, that line though, right? That's good. At a certain point, the big bad wolf is now afraid of us.
Yeah.
So in Dirt, I was mentioning earlier, I talk about the girl in the red cape. We have this switch that gets flipped in us when we don't grow up with a lot. We're running. We're trying to outrun our story. We're running to safety. We're perpetually trying to arrive somewhere. This wolf is ripping at our heels. We finally turn around breathless and wild-eyed, and we realize it. I am the girl in the red cape, but I am also the wolf. And that voice in my head telling me to run and not stop running, that voice was my own.
Wow.
And so in Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots, we come back to that scene. And this time we revisit it from the perspective of the wolf. And it says, chasing, always chasing. This person I'm trying to keep safe is always just out of distance. I've scared her away again. And it says, like, if you have spent your life using the wolf as your adrenaline to drive you, that if you can't stop running, then the wolf can't either. You have somewhere along the line learned how to twist the thorn in its paw, the right pressure points of wide open wounds to hit, to send it roaring back into fight or flight anytime you need it. When it won't run the way that we want to, we cage this wild animal inside us. We make it dance in our three-ring circus show, the one where we always get to be the high wire act. And it says, if we want to be set free of running, then we have to set that wild animal we once became in order to be safe. It's time to set that animal free. Mm-hmm. So yes, at a certain point, we're the ones actually torturing the wolf.
Wow.
Yeah.
See what I mean about amazing writer? Like, I have to, like, I'm just thinking, like, wow, as you're saying that, but I'm like, I gotta get my highlighter out, and I've got to really, like, process. This is good stuff, deep stuff, meaningful. So good, Mary. You say that there's this question that we can ask ourselves, or you have a question that we can ask ourselves to know if we are leaning into our freedom or striving. What is that? How can we give ourselves a quick check?
There are probably a couple of them, but I think one of the best ways to start is to ask, like, is your heart racing? Does your heart feel frenzied, frenetic, frantic? And I tell this very quick story about when Justin and I were very first starting our business together. We went to our first photography conference in LA, sat in like ballrooms for 3 days straight, fluorescently lit ballrooms. And we just needed some sunshine and some wide open space. And so we drive out into the desert on our way to the Grand Canyon. We stop off at Lake Mead to stretch our legs. We're walking down to this blue, tealy water, this man-made lake, to, you know, just look around. And at a certain point, the walkway gives way to floating dock. And now on either side is the hatchery they have on site there. And so the water suddenly is like churning and alive as soon as you walk by, with all of these gaping, gasping, wide open mouths, starving and screaming without making a sound, begging for just crumbs of something, willing to push the other one under just to get crumbs of something. Meanwhile, if they just turned around, there's this whole wide open expanse of freedom and the place they were always meant to be behind them. And so that just became, I mean, it was such a God thing that that happened very early in our business, because for 15 years, anytime we felt that kind of like, you know, you just feel your heart, blah, 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 you know, you're that like frenetic energy, yes. Like, oh, other people are launching a new website. Maybe we should launch a new website. One of us would just look at the other, and we took turns, which is good. We could kind of keep each other in check. We would just look at the other and go, Lake Mead fish. And so, you know, that was just a reminder to say, is my heart racing for no apparent reason? Because that is not the economy or the currency of scarcity that God operates in. Them getting a piece of the pie is not going to leave me with crumbs. So if I'm feeling like it is, that is not of God. There is a plan for us. There is a provision for us. There are good works for us. We are not in a hurry. We are not in a rush. We are not in a race with anyone. Let's slow it down. Let's turn around and go the other direction. Because often what happens is we unintentionally, but still voluntarily, enlist ourselves in these races we never really intended to sign up for. And we are perpetually coming in last place and not understanding. Meanwhile, when we turn around and cast our eyes on the expanse of freedom behind us, we're suddenly first place for what God has in mind for us. And those words, frantic, frenetic, and frenzied, remind me of a scientific term, which is frequency. And frequency is in a molecule of atoms. It is the vibration of how this sort of like left to right energy, of how much energy they exert, all this energy, just to hold it all together, just to stay in one place. And man, is that not exactly that feeling? If my heart is ever racing just to hold it all together, just to stay in one place, that's a really good indication to me that freedom is behind me.
That's really good.
Thank you.
So as we draw to a close in our time together, although I could keep talking to you for a very long time, if someone wants to begin this journey of slow growth and send their roots deep, where do they begin? Obviously, they need to get your book, and I want you in a minute to share where they can find you and find the book. But what is like a step, or how can they prepare their hearts? Because I know in just our talking and in both of our messages, yes, there's action steps to be taken, but it's also really an inner work, isn't it?
Yeah, I love that you phrase that as preparing our hearts, because that's exactly it. That's where it has to start. There's a part in this book, In Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots, where I talk about the difference between weeds and flowers and trees. And I say, we live in a world where it is very, very tempting to say you want to grow just like a weed. I don't know if that's like a common saying, but when I was little growing up in West Virginia and you had like a growth spurt, you're growing just like a weed. And it was a good thing, right? It was like, it meant you were growing really fast and you could see it. Anybody could look at it and could see it. And so we get tempted to go in this world. We get tempted to go, man, yesterday there was nothing and today they're 6 feet tall. Or where yesterday there was nothing, now there's this entire field of them. They're, everything they touch multiplies. They're growing with dizzying height, with dizzying speed. Man, I just want to grow just like a weed. But when I was growing up in West Virginia, there was the single wide trailer. There was an overgrown field of weeds right behind it. And then there was the deep, dark woods beyond where we would always go play. And I can remember very distinctly being a little girl running through that field. Which makes me emotional because it reminds me of that song. There's a United Pursuit song that's like, take me back, running through the fields with you.
I know that one. I love that
one. Mm-hmm. And so we would just run along and like, boop, 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 pull these like 5 and 6 foot towering over our heads weeds out of the ground to see only an inch or half inch of roots were holding them up. They just knocked right over at the first push because they didn't stand for anything. And then, you know, there are flowers which build a beautiful life, or they create something beautiful. And I say, listen, listen, the world needs more beauty. That there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. It's just that I think for all of us, I want us to be something more, and I want us to grow like trees, to think about the redwood giants where we may grow up to be tall, like taller than we could ever imagine, which are dizzying heights. But we're not growing just to be on the surface. We may be a thing of beauty in and of ourselves, but we're not satisfied with merely doing that. We want to bear fruit that can be given away. We want to be a shade and a shelter to others. We want to grow in a way that generations will be changed by this and can make their home underneath this in its protection and its provision. And so for all of us, my hope is that we start to value that giants like that, that there's a reason that the redwood giant is on a different timeline than milkweed. And it's because good things take time and real things take time. And so the heart change that has to happen is we begin to value the character that's being forged in us, the roots that we're putting down in those virtues, who we are becoming and being molded into as image bearers, more than the outcome itself. So the day that I realized I would rather be a kind, gentle, empathetic person that I am than to trade my hard story for an easy story, that was the day that my heart started to get some wisdom, I think. So that's where I would say we begin.
That's beautiful, beautiful imagery. And just, Mary, that's so good. And while you were talking and you mentioned United Pursuit, the Lord reminded me of another one of their songs that's called Not in a Hurry. And as I was not knowing when I was going to start my latest book, Unclutter Your Soul, and just trying to process through it and looking at other people and the timelines they were on, this was the song that he just had me play over and over and over on repeat. And it says, Lord, I don't want to rush out ahead in my own strength when you're right here.
Yes.
And so I think I just right now just have such a heart for the listeners, no matter where you're at or where you're wanting to be, to just not be in a hurry. God has success for you in your timing with him. And I know Mary's book is going to encourage you and equip you It's going to resource you with what you need, but it's also going to help you to walk in that slow growth so you have those strong roots. So, Mary, tell us where listeners can find your book.
Yeah, yes. So marymorantz.com is a good hub for all the things. You can link over to the book, Slow Growth Equals Strong Roots. You can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or pretty much anywhere books are sold. I feel like a really good place to kind of get like a, this will send you to all the other things is when you take that quiz at achieverquiz.com, or you can go to marymorantz.com/quiz. It's going to show you some pre-order glimpses of the book. It's going to point you to some podcast episodes that we specifically curated for each type. Like start here, listen to these episodes first, if you're a masquerader, if you're the illusionist, whatever.
Ooh, I can't wait.
And so I think that's just like, if you're like, oh, that's so much to remember, just go to achieverquiz.com and that will get you into the amusement park that is Mary, and it's at Mary Morantz on the socials, mostly for me. That means Instagram, and I love DMs. So if you listen to this and it spoke to you, come say hi. I'd love to meet you.
Yes. Oh, you're one of my favorite new people, Mary. I hope we can meet up in real life, IRL, one day. Before we close up here, will you tell our listeners, I love to ask about our everyday life. So will you let us know one thing that is making your everyday life better?
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to go, there are a lot I could name. I could name my very fluffy golden retrievers, Goodspeed and Atticus, who are just like comfort dogs through all the stressful days. My amazing husband, Justin. So those are just, we're going to call those givens. And then I will bonus that with my Peloton.
All right.
Specific, which sounds like such a indulgent answer, but the reason for that is actually deeper. And that is that we got our Peloton right as I was writing the first drafts of Dirt. And it has been a constant source of coaching and companionship and inspiration and like pep talks when I most need them. And one of the instructors talks about how you have to metabolize all of this stress we're holding on to, all this pressure and all of the outside expectations. Like you take that 20 or 30 minutes for you to metabolize everything that the world puts on you and tells you that you should be. And when I was writing Dirt, and this is where I'll tell this story really quickly. I wrote the whole first draft, turned it in, quickly realized that was not what I wanted this book to stand for. It was very angry and bitter and like just getting all the poison out on the page for the first time. So I determined to gut 50,000 words and rewrite 50,000 new words. So it ended up being 70,000 words total in 2 months' time. I had 2 months until we had to hand it off. And I was already at the end of myself, Trina. I thought, I am completely exhausted. I have already climbed a mountain getting the first draft out. I'm done.
Mm-hmm. I'm so feeling that pressure for you right now. Yeah. I know what 50,000 words means. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. Like 50,000 good words, not just like quantity. And so every day I would wake up, do my morning routine, talk to God about it, say, I don't have anything in me. And you say, okay, let's just sit down and see. And I would end up writing inevitably just provision. It was like manna. It was like manna of words, 500 or 750 words. And then I would go hop on this bike, completely thinking I was done for the day. And one of the instructors, whichever one it was, would say something to the effect of, Kendall Toole in particular said to me, we didn't come out to this mountain to teeter on the edge of greatness, to teeter on the edge of legendary. We came to this mountain to rise. And I was like, yeah. And then I would go get another 500 or 750 words. But between those two, just like to keep me kind of going. And I'll tell you what, I have never experienced a more tangible experience of God than the way that he wrote that book in those 2 months. So I continue to come back to the bike to metabolize what needs to go, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might have me sold on a Peloton, and I'm not a cycle bike class. I forget what it's called. There's a word for the biking class. I'm not that person. I'm the walker and the Pilates girl. But now I'm like, no, maybe I need that person telling me, come on, get to that mountaintop.
Oh, it's good. It's really good. And I didn't think I was a spinning person
either. You know? Thank you. that was the word.
I'm obsessed with it now. I'm obsessed with it. Yeah.
Oh, that is awesome. I know so many people love Peloton. Yep. Well, thank you for being with us, Mary. It has been an absolute joy. And I'm so excited about this message, this book, the imagery. Oh my goodness, it's so beautiful. So everyone, please, please grab your copy. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
Hey friends, have you gotten a copy of my new book, Unclutter Your Soul, Overcome What Overwhelms You? It is available now wherever books are sold. You can also visit my website, trinamcneely.com/uncluttery-your-soul to find out more about the book and to download sample chapters. You can grab them in PDF download format or grab an audio chapter today. I want to help you overcome what's overwhelming you in your everyday life, to let go of stress and anxiety, and to make room for more peace and joy. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of The Lovely Life. If you love what you hear on this podcast and want other people to know that their everyday life can be beautiful and meaningful, then I want you to leave a 5-star review and take a moment to subscribe to this podcast. Did you know that we have an online community where we continue the discussion and cheer each other on? I want to personally invite you to join. Simply go to facebook.com/groups/lovelylifecommunity. For show notes and to subscribe to episode emails, visit trinamcneely.com/podcast. Until next time, friends, here's to leaving behind perfect and learning to live better.